going to take about 5 minutes now and ask the panel if they want to respond or continue the conversation, and then we'll come back to the mics. Okay, so.
I think it's important to remember the government example in front of us this month. You know, their solution to poverty really is when you're a little cash short, you got to take the marijuana, trade it for cocaine, across Canada, buy a few votes, and handle the situation. So that's one strategy I'm thinking about. I am interested in whether anybody else has got any ideas about direct action strategies that actually do cost businesses money, particularly strategic businesses. I mean, I keep running through all the old slogans in my mind to see if I can dredge up anything that's of any use, like, you know, thinking globally and acting locally. I can't remember all the parts of the Italian strategy that I remember being so impressed by that was we won't pay, which had to do with simply going into the rich grocery stores, not the mom-and-pop stores, of course, the big chain stores, in groups and coming out with groceries for people. Now, since people are being criminalized anyway, and I'm willing to take that kind of a criminalization strategy, I'm interested in, you know, whether anybody else has been dreaming up any kinds of direct action strategies that we could actually do anything with. And the other thing is that I quite agree that this is an ideological struggle. There's some way in which we're losing on the ideas. And so I do think we need propaganda strategies, really straightforward, really loud, really obnoxious propaganda strategies. Like part of why I wanted to talk about guaranteed annual income is that I think a lot of the young women that I'm working with have never heard the expression, and they don't carry the kind of hope that I was raised on that it was going to exist. So there's a kind of entitlement that they don't experience, that I did experience, and that entitlement made me bolder. It made me ask for things, it made me expect things, it made me demand things, it made me fight for things. So I'm sure that we should be involved in propaganda strategies.
Following up on what Lee has said on the ideological struggle, one way in which the right-wing ideology has managed to assume an ascendancy is by the focus on tax cuts and by the ability to convince people that they cannot afford these taxes, that they're bleeding because of these taxes. And of course, that's the way that they can undermine social programs, and to some extent, not in a complete extent by any means, but to some extent they've been successful in that. And I think that we need to start to articulate that the problem is not that taxes are too high, but that wages are too low. Mm-hmm. Because if the issue is that people can't afford to support social programs, then we've got to say, well, why can't they afford them? What's happened to their wage packet? And that, of course, is the last thing in the world that the corporators want to hear, because they're on the other end of paying those wages. But I think that there are reasonably simple concepts and simple slogans that we should try to harness to attack that ideology that is being passed as some kind of natural wisdom.
I like the idea, Lee, of the going into the grocery stores and that, and similar sorts of approaches, you know, Home Depot or those sorts of things.
First, Kim, we'll come bail you
out. Okay. I think you've got 24-hour ones here now, don't you? Yeah. So, but I think in terms of the propaganda and linked to some of the questions earlier, I mean, I think we need to remember that there are great pockets of money being spent, that when we talk about challenging the propaganda, I mean, $7 billion on corrections to correct people trying to survive an increasingly inhospitable, unsurvivable series of policies and legislative changes. I mean, there's a perfect example. I mean, I'm all for closing Burnaby. What we should be doing is having those women move into the community the risk that they pose to you and I on a day-to-day basis, and for that matter, almost every other prison in this country, is zero to our safety. To they may pose some risk to property, private property, from time to time. They may pose some risk to our psyches, our comfort level, particularly those who have been increasingly made literally crazy because of the lack of supports, the lack of resources available. But, you know, increasingly we're seeing people being criminalized because of what they need, not because of a risk they pose to anybody, the risk increasingly to them. So I think we could talk about the clear need to be looking at reallocating those resources. It's no accident it's the only place that can't say no anymore. It's no accident it's the only place that has always has room on the floor, by the toilet, wherever the person is going to be put. And so I think calling for and challenging some of those notions, realizing that every single person on welfare could be criminalized because it's impossible to survive on welfare, and challenging all of those kinds of propaganda that it's, there's any kind of deserving notion, that in fact it's purposeful who we're going to be targeting continually, is really important, and then demanding those resources be allocated. Imagine, I mean, I want to go back to if we did criminalize, we've got all kinds of alternatives for people of resources and privilege, right? We need to be challenging who's being criminalized and for what. And if we did start demanding that people be charged for misusing funds, people be charged for, you know, I mean, actually be pursued for the stuff, this, you know, horrendous reality that's unfolding right now in this province around, you know, organized crime in government, you know, is, I think those are some of the propaganda challenges we need to make. And I, a couple people were shaking their heads when I said crime prevention. Lest you be confused, when I say that get rid of the band-aids like crime prevention, why do we continue to accept those lenses? Why do we continue to accept that feeding kids in schools because there's inadequate food anywhere else is crime prevention? That means that you're doing it because you're afraid that kid is going to be a criminal, that you're feeding teen moms, because otherwise that fetus is a potential criminal. I mean, think about how we twist even how we think about issues when we accept those kinds of labels. And so I think we have to challenge all of that kind of propaganda. So
that I think there's a great value to being menacing, and that I would like them to think that children are going to rise up. I don't want anybody to be reassured that I am not a problem, that I don't have guns, that I don't consider armed struggle. I don't want anybody to feel too comfortable about that at all.
Would like to lie, make perhaps one strategy, or maybe one in front of you. Back in the NDP days, when they cut $50 from welfare checks,
right,
for single people and people who didn't have children, couples that didn't have children, I wondered how much money that was. And so I phoned the regional office in Victoria, and I said, so how many people, you know, single people, employables, and families lost this amount of money? And I actually, at this point, forget how many people they said it was in Victoria. I think it was about 18,000. There was a lot of people. There were a lot of people on welfare back then. And so I thought, $50 a month, 18,000 people, 12 months. I did it on a piece of paper, and it came up to $8.5 million, and I thought, a year, and I thought, no. So I got the calculator out and I did it with the calculator, and the calculator agreed with me, and I'm really bad with calculators and punching in the wrong number, so I did it three times. And I came up with the same amount of money. What was lost to the economy of Victoria was $8.5 million. Every penny, you could almost guarantee, would have been spent in the local economy. It didn't get put into, you know, into GICS. It didn't get put into holidays in Maui. It didn't, you know, it would have been spent on bread and milk and bus fare and rent in Victoria. And I'm wondering if we need to find some way, and I don't know how we would find out what the number, but how much money our local economies, could we get somebody to crunch the numbers and say, Victoria's going to lose this much when these people, when people are cut off, or they've already lost this much due to the cuts that have gone on over the last 2 years. Because we've got local businesses that are small businesses that are crying, that are closing their doors, that are, you know, wondering where the tourists are, that are going to, and blaming it on the salmon that aren't showing up. And, and all of those things are part of the problem. But I think a really significant part of the problem is that poor people don't have enough money, you know? And so I'm wondering if there's some way that maybe we can't do that, you know, if there isn't somebody here or somebody here who knows somebody, that we couldn't begin to put together some of those numbers and just begin to show our communities how important we are to them.